Second half of the program begins right now. It's a Friday. Every Monday and Friday, we go around the country 2 minutes at a time talking to the people, covering the stories where they're happening. They're happening in Miami today. That's where we begin. Kevin Rogers, WQAM in Miami, is there. K-Rog, how are you, buddy?
All right, good to talk to you again.
And it's good to speak with you. What's the bigger story? Tannehill being back and looking pretty good, or more kneeling going on with the NFL players?
You know, down here, I would hope it would be Tannehill coming back. Yeah, he didn't play at all last year, missed the final four games 2 seasons ago, and they made the playoffs. I would hope that's the bigger story. You know, this with the kneeling, I mean, I'm really over it. I mean, I'm sure you are. A lot of people are. It's just, you know, it gets to a point where how many times do you have to say what the reason is why you're kneeling, and yet there are people that think it's for other reasons, and it's just, you know, and I'm sure people saw the president's tweet, and, you know, it's just kind of like, my goodness, you know, it's just turned into this whole thing that it really shouldn't be at this point. And, you know, the players have been given the option to stay in the locker room, you know, during the anthem, and I wonder, you know, if those players would. But, you know what, I think Kenny Stills is going to continue to stay out there, and he keeps stating his point on why he's doing it. And, you know what? He's going to keep doing it, and we should all just kind of, like, accept it and move on. I know a lot of people don't like that answer, but it's like, I don't know how much longer this is going to drag out as far as, like, the discussion about the anthem.
I think it's going to drag out till the next collective bargaining agreement. I think it's going to continue. I think the owners, basically, by suspending the policy they put in place, have waved the white flag, and they're going to work with the players. The players are not going to give. But the more Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job, Eric Reid doesn't have a job, if Kenny Stills doesn't have a job, if everyone who has been a consistent kneeler no longer has a job, we will see how it goes. Marcus Peters is one of the guys that the Rams acquired that they didn't give a contract extension to. They did give one to you know, a couple of different guys that they acquired, the Cooks. I'm trying to think who else they gave it. I know they extended somebody else. But anyway, if Marcus Peters doesn't get it, you have to wonder, is this how they're doing it? That one by one, the owners have colluded or individually have come to the conclusion that they're not going to give contracts to players that kneel. I think it's a showdown that's looming. I'm with you. Let's talk about the football part, and that is Tannehill. Is he, what, 100% back, ready to go? And what does that mean for the Dolphins moving forward?
I would think he is. I mean, after, you know, he ended up having the surgery last year when he suffered the injury in practice, and he didn't end up having the surgery after he got hurt last December, or the December before, against Arizona. A lot of people questioned that one. He kind of let it heal, and you know, people wondered if that was the right route to go. And, you know, obviously the Jay Cutler experiment really didn't work out. And, I mean, honestly, it's Ryan's team. You know, you look behind him, it's David Fales, it's Brock Osweiler, who continues to find jobs, and like that, those are your options behind Ryan Tannehill. And Jarvis Landry's gone to Cleveland, and I'm sure he's thrilled about it, because from everything he said, that he wasn't happy down here. And, you know, go to Cleveland, have fun with it. You know, 0-16 last year. But you know, they pick up Albert Wilson from the Chiefs. They get Amendola. Yeah, they still have Kenny Stills. There's weapons there, and you just wonder, you know, now that Tannehill, he's healthy, that if the offensive line can protect them, that this team can be competitive and fight for a wild card spot, because there's no way they're winning a division title in the AFC East.
Yeah, 2 years ago in the playoffs. Right now, nobody's got anybody within like two or three games of the New England Patriots in the AFC East. If anyone's going to challenge, you'd think it'd be the team that has Ryan Tannehill and not the two teams with the young quarterback. So that's one good thing. I mean, Dolphins and Bills, theoretically, you could have four wins there, and maybe that does get the Dolphins up to 10 wins. How about the Marlins? What's the feeling about where they're at and what the season has been and what they did at the deadline? I bring that up because it was doom and gloom. They're going to be the worst team ever. Meanwhile, here in Kansas City, we were talking about a team maybe making a run at 500, and it turns out that the Royals are the ones that are dueling the Orioles for the worst record in baseball. So is anybody looking at the Marlins saying, hey, maybe this strategy wasn't the worst, or is it still too soon for that?
For the people still following the Marlins down here, obviously now with football season, you know, upon us, I mean, there's nothing bad you can say about them at this point. And I'm not going to, you know, say Derek Jeter is the executive of the year, but, you know, like you said, this is a team that's supposed to win 50 games. And they've been very competitive. They've had stretches where they haven't played well. But at the same time, when you look at their division, you pass the Mets, I mean, really, Philadelphia, could win it. The Braves have been very good. Washington is still good. It's a good division. So you're playing a lot of these teams that, you know, they're not beating the Phillies a lot. They've had a lot of problems with the Braves. So you're racking up a lot of losses against really good teams. And the National League is extremely competitive this year with all the teams that are hovering, you know, around 500 or above 500. See what the West is like, you know, minus the Padres. You have all very good teams out there. So for what they've done without Stanton, without Ozuna, without Yelich, I think that there's nothing more you can say than it's been a successful season, even though we know they're not going to the playoffs. But this is a team that was supposed to be terrible, and they've been a lot more competitive. We'll see how that translates into 2019. But for right now, nobody can say anything bad about this team.
Is Dwayne Wade going to China?
I got him on hold. I have no idea. You know what? If Dwayne Wade ends up retiring, he had a very successful NBA career. If he wants to come back with the Heat, I'm sure they will take him. But obviously his services, they're not going to, you know, he's not going to end up making $20 million a year in the NBA anymore. He's just not, you know, even though we know a lot of players make that kind of money that aren't even close to his ability level. But, you know, he's just gotten towards the end of the line, and hopefully he can come back with the Heat for one more year. But if not, it was still a pretty good run.
Yeah. All right. But it's not a big pressing concern, clearly, for anybody in Miami, because he doesn't play like he used to. Legends are great, but the guys that everybody loves are the guys who can play right now. That's the reality of professional sports. Kevin Rogers in Miami. Great stuff as always, buddy. Appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
All right, too, Seren. Thank you.
Brett Jensen, Fox Sports Charlotte in Charlotte, North Carolina is next. Brett, how are you?
Just fine, sir.
Cam Newton, Kelvin Benjamin, why so much bad blood?
You know, I don't know where it actually came from. And, you know, it's been a wide discussion here. I mean, you know, I know nationally Kelvin Benjamin's been getting ripped and criticized for saying what he said. But I will say this. If you actually look and break down what Kelvin Benjamin said, he's actually pretty accurate in what he said. In that, I mean, you know, he talked about Cam Newton's accuracy, and everyone knows that Cam Newton has an issue throwing the ball accurately. I mean, last year he was 24th in quarterback rating and 27th in completion percentage. And that's been a major bugaboo his whole career. And then they talked about, you know, he wanted to talk about not knowing the game. Well, I can tell you that for the first 6 years of Cam Newton's career, he wasn't allowed to call audibles because he was having hard times reading defense. And he went up to the line, and sort of like in college, depending on what the safety was doing, he either went to run or he went to pass. But he wasn't allowed to change the plays at the line of scrimmage just because he simply has had a hard time reading defenses his entire career. And that hasn't changed. And so basically that's what Kelvin Benjamin said. And in theory, I think he was – pretty close to being dead on accurate, but at the same time, I have no idea why in the world he would say that. As a matter of fact, when Cam Newton flipped his truck, I went to the hospital and was doing live reports from there, and I just purely by accident, purely by mistake, wound up in the waiting room where some people were in a little private waiting room, and Kelvin Benjamin was the first and only player to show up that day at the hospital when Cam Newton flipped his truck and everyone was concerned about him. So, I don't know what has happened, but for whatever reason, he decided to do it.
Is that the problem with Cam Newton, you know, beyond maybe some of the immature things we see at the podium, right? You mentioned all the football part of it. But the fact that he will get into a verbal altercation with Kelvin Benjamin on the field now shows that he is immature, and that's what, you know, maybe Kelvin Benjamin was his strongest supporter and he felt let down. I don't know what went on between the two of them, but he clearly was supporting him that day that you saw him in the waiting room. Is this what it is? He's just a child?
Well, you know what, though? They've been saying that about Cam Newton since the day he entered the league. Oh, he's just immature. He's just got it growing up to do. He's been in the league for like 7 years. Like, when does when do you stop saying that he's immature and that's just who he is? I mean, so I don't know. I mean, he got in a well-publicized fight with Josh Norman his last year here with the Panthers before he went to the Redskins. I can tell you this. He's been aloof with his teammates his entire career. He and Steve Smith did not get along at all. Like, there was a famous story in ESPN the magazine about how Thomas Davis, early in Cam's career, hey, man, we're all going to go work out and lift weights. And Cam's like, no, I'm good, thanks. And, you know, John Beeson had a huge charity event where the Panthers served as waiters. And Cam Newton was the last one to arrive. He showed up an hour late. He was the only one to show up with bodyguards. And he showed up in a three-piece suit instead of jeans and a shirt. And Beeson told him, dude, just go home. And, I mean, that's who he is. He's just a weird guy. Doesn't have a lot of close friends on the team. Never has. But this whole thing about immature, I mean, this is who he is from day one. I mean, I don't think it has anything to do with immaturity. This is just who he is. I just don't think he gets it a lot of times. But again, I have no idea what has happened between him and Kelvin Benjamin or what transpired that.
Okay. The Panthers coming off a playoff season, big expectations for the Falcons and Saints nationally. Most people expect the Panthers to regress. What do you expect?
Yeah, I totally expect them to regress. I mean, they've got issues on the offensive line. Their secondary is in complete disarray. And they've got a bunch of young wide receivers, unproven wide receivers. So, I think they're going to regress. And, I mean, if you assume that either the Falcons or the Saints are going to get one of the wild card spots, does that mean, you know, then you start looking at, okay, what's going on with Green Bay, Minnesota, like all the other NFC teams? You know, Dallas, are they going to get an NFC, you know, wild card spot? So, at the end of the day, I think the Panthers are on the outside looking in. And plus, they have a relatively difficult schedule, much more so than last year. So, yeah, I would be very surprised if they made the playoffs. I mean, I think 9 wins should be their goal.
College basketball has new rules, and it has to deal with a number of them, at least the ones that are getting the most reaction from coaches. Players' ability to declare for the draft, go into the draft, have the draft happen, not get drafted, and then be able to come back. All the rules in general, what is the reaction along Tobacco Road?
You know, it's the only thing that's really come out about it was basically, you know, remember how the NCAA said that, basically USA Basketball is going to be in charge of this and you know, determining who's going to be getting the agents, not the NBA and not the NCAA. And, you know, Mike Krzyzewski is very prominent in USA Basketball. And, you know, the only thing, that has come out of Tobacco Road was just that whole situation where he's like, wait, how are we going to be in charge of this? Like, we have nothing to do with college and we have nothing to do with the NBA. Why are we involved with this? And who's going to be the ones making the decision? So, I mean, other than that, there really hasn't been much reaction. There really hasn't been much. I mean, both of the coaches have been pretty much MIA this summer. So, but that's really the only thing that's really come out of it, about it going, you know, why is USA, you know, why are they going to be the ones dealing with who determines who gets an agent, who's not allowed to get an agent.
Is there some fear, though, from Duke fans? I mean, the one and dones are where it would seem to be a problem. You know, you recruit a guy, you recruit over, and all of a sudden he turns around and comes back. That would seem to be where there's the most potential for a problem, and Kentucky and Duke would seem to be the schools that would have the biggest issue with it.
Well, and you know, and I think you're right, but the funny thing is, you know, Krzyzewski held this big press conference, I guess it was in February, and he was talking about, I think it was in February, and he said that he hates the one-and-done rule and that they either need to get rid of it altogether where you can just go straight in the NBA or have, you know, you have to spend a couple of years in college. You know, and he was one of the ones, when it first happened, hated it, and he wasn't going to change his recruiting style. He was still only going to recruit 3- and 4-year players, and we know how that all turned out. So, but, yeah, that's an interesting point that you bring up because, like I said, he was the one who's been dead set against one and done from day one. And now, you look at who they've got coming in this year. I mean, they've got the number one point guard, the number one shooting guard, the number one small forward, all coming in. And then I think the number three power forward, all coming into Duke this year as freshmen. Well, what happens if all those guys don't go back, go to the NBA, like you said, in theory, 2 years down the road, and then all of a sudden – you start recruiting on top of them. Like you said, that's going to be a difficult situation. And I think you bring that up where a lot of people haven't thought about that. I think that's a pretty good point.
Brett Jensen and Charlotte, great stuff, buddy. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot, man. You too.
Adam Wexler, NBC Channel 2 in Houston, Texas is next. Adam, how are you?
Good.
Melo's a rocket. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Because it didn't work in Oklahoma City.
I think it's a good thing. And, you know, I actually was looking over the road to get here. All this time in Denver and New York and then Oklahoma City. You know, Chauncey Billups, Russell Westbrook, Allen Iverson, probably the three best players he's ever played with. And none of them are as good as either of the new point guards he'll be playing with this year in Harden and Chris Paul. If Melo's mind is right, if he's down for taking threes and getting layups all, you know, game long, every game, play a little defense, he'll be fine here. The fit will be fine. And I think the Rockets have wanted to do this for long enough that there's been so much talk behind the scenes with the players and Melo and even with Mike D'Antoni making sure this would work that, honestly, I don't think it's a huge concern, not to mention there is zero risk. It doesn't work, they release him. Simple. He makes no money.
Yeah, that is a big difference from what was going on in Oklahoma City, no doubt. You mentioned if he's down with shooting threes, he can shoot threes, but you wouldn't call him a three-point shooter. Is that the expectation that his game is going to change to fit the style?
Well, you might not call him a three-point shooter, but he has actually evolved with the rest of the league. The last 2 years, he set career highs and the highest percentage of his shots that came behind the three-point line, and it's gone up tremendously quickly. 2 years ago, his last year in New York, 30% of his shots were threes, and then this past year, 40% of his shots with Oklahoma City were threes. It's probably going to go up this year because offensively, he replaces, you know, what they lose in Bamute and in Trevor Ariza. And in my opinion, in this offense, with the number of looks he's going to get, he's a significantly better offensive option. And I think his three-point shooting will at least equal what they both provided, if not more.
Okay, we'll see what he does on the defensive side as well when it's all said and done. Astros making the move for Roberto Osuna. You know, guys like Justin Verlander have been very adamant about speaking out against domestic violence, reportedly a closed-door team meeting. How is he fitting into the fabric of this team?
I mean, based on that meeting and how things have transpired since then, everything seems fine. I'm not sure the amount of details he was even willing to share and what he did to ease their minds, so to speak, about what has, or again, as we all don't know, what hasn't happened in that situation that allowed him to accept that 75-game suspension without appeal. Everything from a baseball standpoint is clearly fine, and I think most of the players, and we've talked to most of them, including Verlander, about it, they're kind of in a wait-and-see mode, which means they're just integrating him into the clubhouse. They know he can help the team from a baseball standpoint, but they're just kind of waiting for the process to play out. And it probably won't even play out until at least, you know, mid-September, if not in the offseason.
Why make this gamble? I mean, they're already such a good team. Why did they feel that this was something they needed to do?
That's an awesome question. That's exactly the point of view I take with that. This clubhouse, to me, and I think you guys experienced the very same thing when Kansas City a couple of years ago was so good, I think a lot of people pointed to the culture that they created and the group of players that were on that team, whether it was the homegrown group or just people who seemed to fit in so well because of the leaders that were homegrown players like, you know, Gordon and guys like that for Kansas City, and obviously Altuve and Correa and Bregman and those types and Springer. They've built such a great chemistry inside the clubhouse, and I thought that was a huge reason why they were who they were. Clearly, they're incredibly talented. So I asked the very same question. Of all the things to do, you made a move that clearly could backfire. And I just thought it was shocking that they would go that route. I think that they've had enough conversation with the team, the general manager and the owner met with the team in advance of Osuna joining the team and as it was all playing out, as they were pulling the trigger on it. So I think they've done everything they think they needed to do to kind of quell that before it blew up. But it does seem like an extremely risky move for a team who might very well have been good enough to win it all or could have made another move to improve them.
The Texans, expectations for them are what? Deshaun Watson was so good last year. Also, maybe, you know, kind of so bad, too. The 8 INTs in 6 games, I don't think enough people are enough is being made of that part of it. But you get why. 19 touchdowns in 6 games. He plays just a little bit against the Chiefs. I assume he's 100% or close to it right now, and the sky is the limit with him.
Again, just very few plays last night, but that's a pretty good indicator of his health situation. If a guy's coming back from an ACL injury and he's not 100%, there's no way he's playing any games or any plays, anything in the preseason. He's 100%, totally healthy. He has no concerns about the injury, and he's been telling us that since the offseason, since before they even got to training camp. And again, based on, you know, they were on the field, he and J.J. Watt and Tyrann Mathieu and DeAndre Hopkins in that sauna that was Arrowhead Stadium yesterday afternoon between 4 and game time. They were out there on the field a good hour working out and just kind of getting conditioning in. And most of those guys in that group did not play. Watson was one of the few that did. They're not concerned. I don't believe they should be concerned either. The turnovers you mentioned, to me, I don't think it's a big concern. I know Russell Wilson came into the league, and that wasn't an issue for him, and Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady and these elite quarterbacks, that's not something that's really ever been a part of their game, the mistakes. But here in Houston, I think they've finally got a quarterback who can make the plays to overcome the mistakes. He could have a 15-interception season, and I doubt they would care because he's going to somehow find a way to create 35 to 40 touchdowns either on the ground or through the air. I think that's the kind of expectation they have for him.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. Make or break for O'Brien?
Probably not, because he got his extension. They just hired a new GM. He's going to have a healthy quarterback. Things would have to go tremendously badly and it not be related to health. I mean, a repeat of a 4-win season or worse, and I just really don't see that happening. His health is not the main reason why. And even in that situation, they just gave the guy an incredible vote of confidence. And I don't think Bob McNair, 1 year into that, is going to turn around and say, all right, we made a mistake. You're out. We're going in another direction. He has been very, very reluctant to fire head coaches pretty much forever. It took forever for Gary Kubiak to get relieved of duties here in Houston. And I think McNair hasn't changed the way he thinks about that. I don't believe it's a make or break year for O'Brien, but I do think they'll have a good season.
Adam Wexler in Houston. Great stuff, buddy. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
You find Roxy Bernstein in the Bay Area, 95.7 The Game, ESPN, and, of course, A's Radio. Roxy, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, sir. Ryan, what's going on?
Well, John Gruden and Khalil Mack, how do you take over and get sideways with your star player is the question most people want to know.
Well, it certainly has not lacked for drama around the Raiders and that whole situation with their preseason opener tonight against the Lions. And right now, it's a stare down, and who's going to blink first? I do believe at some point that Mack will be in. I think both sides are frustrated. But I think cooler heads will prevail, and let's face it, the minute he starts missing game checks, I think that's when you get nervous. But I think at some point they will find some common ground, and I do believe that Khalil Mack will be in.
Okay. How about this? They don't want him in. They want to trade him. I brought this up because everybody here in Kansas City is certainly giddy with the fact that Khalil Mack is not in camp, and we're laughing at the Raiders and laughing at John Gruden right now. But I did point out, you know, the New England Patriots have nobody other than Rob Gronkowski and Tom Brady, and I think Gronk is kind of there because Brady wants him. I think the Patriot way of doing things is don't ever have the highest paid guy at a position. If you got a guy who's the best at his position, trade him for more picks, but get depth. Because guys get hurt. And we've watched the Chiefs go into the postseason without Eric Berry or without Justin Houston, two guys that are the highest paid at their position, and they can't go anywhere in the postseason. Is it possible that this is what they want? They ultimately want to trade Khalil Mack so that they can spread that money around more places and not have $100-plus million tied up in one guy?
I don't think so, Saran, because we see how disruptive he can be defensively and how dominant of a pass rusher. And without him, the Raider defense would struggle. Look, they struggle even with him. And so what you're saying makes some sense in terms of the Raiders, all right, trying to get more talent and depth on that side of the football. But the depth will be tested tonight. And where can the Raiders step up in the absence of Khalil Mack? And for the Raider defense in the long run, I think they're clearly better with him. And I honestly don't see him going anywhere, even with the frustration from both sides right now that he's not in camp. I do believe the Raiders will keep him around, that they want to bring a star to Vegas when they move there, and that he is in the plans. And if they can't come to an agreement, well, they can always franchise tag him. And so I think the Raiders feel that they're in a position of strength more so than Mack is at this point.
Okay, fair enough. Is there still a confidence that Gruden is on top of it, or is there some fear right now that maybe the game passed him by?
Oh, no, there's confidence, and they're 100% committed to Gruden. And, look, they have a lot invested in him, as you know. He certainly makes everybody sit up and watch and get excited about things. But, look, if he struggles, if he goes 4-12 this year or 6-10, all right, maybe it isn't as happy for the Raiders as everybody thought it was going to be. And let's face it, they're probably – look, they're not as bad as they were last year. They're probably not as good as they were the year before. But I think they benefit from the easier schedule this year. And Gruden has the potential to get the Raiders back to the playoffs in his first year.
Yeah, well, he's got the headlines there in the Bay Area. I mean, he's not going to be there forever, but he's certainly getting headlines. No doubt about that. A's continue to add bullpen pieces. Is this all that they need to finally go deep into the postseason?
Well, I think they're going to try to get another closer at some point today because they clearly don't have enough.
Yeah, right.
I mean, Fernando Rodney Seren, he's going to be your sixth-inning pitcher. That's what he is. Because they already have Trevino for the seventh, Familia for the eighth, and Trinan in closing. So Rodney is brought in, and the A's only need to get five innings from their starter now. And that was the plan. And they didn't like the market for starting pitching. Yes, they did acquire Mike Fiers, and he made an impressive debut against the Dodgers when the A's beat Kershaw on Wednesday night. But with now they're looking to just get five innings from their starter because they have an absolutely loaded bullpen. And that's where I think the A's figured, look, if we can't get the starting pitching we want, let's bolster the back end. They saw how the Royals won a World Series. And I think that the A's are taking a page out of the Royals' playbook, shorten the game, get those lights-out relievers, and they're setting themselves up. I think if you're the Yankees, do you want to see the A's in a wild card, considering they could turn it into a five-inning game like Kansas City did?
No. No, I don't. I don't. And I like what the A's are doing. And I'd like to see Billy Beane finally push deep into the postseason with one of his teams. I like that they're still making moves. I mean, I asked Jason Stark, did they not do enough that they're this close? Is this, you know, kind of his Achilles heel? He gets them good enough to get in there, but not good enough to go deep. He does seem to be maybe have more of a sense of urgency now, doesn't he?
He does. And look, he made an aggressive move back in 2014 to get John Lester, which was uncharacteristic of Billy Beane. It was an enormous trade at the deadline when they got rid of Cespedes and picked up Lester for the wild card, and it didn't work. And Lester started that game. Yeah, the A's were in position to beat the Royals. As you know, in 2014, they couldn't close it out. Kansas City won the game. And so I think he's tweaked his formula because not only has he brought in, okay, Fiers to give them another veteran starter, and now with the pickup of Rodney yesterday. But Sean Kelly was also, I think, a really good pickup from Washington. So that bullpen is absolutely stacked. They only have one left-handed reliever. Now, selfishly, I'd like to see them go get a second lefty, but those guys are few and far between, and I think there's still a number of teams looking for bullpen help. But for the A's, I think they could also use a left-handed bat, which they've been tough to try to pry away from other teams. But I know they like this lineup. They hit a ton of home runs, as you know, and they find ways just to win ball games and grind it out. And there are, since middle of June, the Oakland A's are the best team in baseball.
Do they, if they need a left-handed bat, do they need a Duda?
Billy, I think Billy Beane has always had a special place for Lucas Duda.
Yeah.
But the thing is,
Royals fans have a special place for him, too. It's probably not in as high a spot as perhaps Billy Beane would have him in.
That's why a guy like Ryan Healy was expendable, because they had no place to play him.
Yeah, yeah. Roxy Bernstein in the Bay Area. Great stuff, buddy. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend.
You too, Seren. Talk to you soon, bud.